This is Sarah Robinson, and you're listening to Conscious Creating, the Art of Transformation. Today I'll be talking with Phil Cousineau, author of 18 books of nonfiction, 2 books of poetry, and over a dozen documentary films. Phil Cousineau, welcome to Conscious Creating.
Happy to be with you this morning.
You know, I'd like to say right up front what a pleasure it's been preparing for our talk today. I studied your life and work, and I felt like there were so many levels on which I could make a connection with what you were writing. And while your work is certainly scholarly, I find it highly accessible, and I think the reason for that is because you have a tendency towards vulnerability and self-revelation in your work. And I wanted to start by asking you if you feel vulnerable in writing the intimate details of your life.
Yes, of course, but that's intentional. I suspect it comes out of many years of lecturing, teaching courses from mythology to creativity to coaching sports with kids, and discovering that unless I speak or tell my stories or give advice in anything from writing to sports, unless I'm vulnerable, personable, and intimate, my audience doesn't have permission, so to speak, to open themselves up. If a teacher or writer tries to appear all knowing, then it becomes a one-side show. And so I've decided to arrive at some kind of weave between good scholarly work, but also an intimate approach to writing, because it's really a two-way street. There is no book without a reader. There's no film without an audience. And so I've discovered that the more honest I can be about my life growing up on the streets of Detroit, working in steel factories, traveling around the world on a shoestring, writing 20 hours a day, if I can be ruthlessly honest about that, it gives people the courage of their conviction to keep going, even if it's a struggle.
Well, and I think it makes your story, you write a lot about myth, and so your story becomes a mythic journey as well.
Yes, that's right. I recently came across some phone notes that I took from my conversation I had with the famous mythologist Joseph Campbell years ago. I worked with him for many years on the film The Hero's Journey, and knew that every meeting I had with him here in San Francisco or New York or Honolulu or even a phone call was archival worthy, so to speak. So I was surreptitiously taking notes of all of our conversations over the years, and I just came across some note that I stuck in a book somewhere in which he told me that if he went back to rewrite his most famous book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, he would preface it with a simple sentence that he thought cut to the core of the hero's journey, and he said, all hero's journeys, all stories begin with the hero, duck. There's no story with someone who's comfortable, with somebody who has all the answers.
There you go.
The story begins when someone is restless, anxious, insecure, perhaps even angry, but duck. And the first move out of there, like Brer Rabbit trying to extricate himself out of the tar pit, is the beginning of the story. It's the beginning of the advantage. So in my books, writing about mythology or travel or sports, if I can begin there, I think people identify with me, the author, in a much more natural way. Because who isn't stuck at some point in their life?
Another guest of mine, when I asked him this question, because it comes up a lot for people who are writing inspirational type work, and this is a singer-songwriter, David Wilcox, and I asked him you know, if it was scary to be vulnerable. And he said, it's only scary if you do it halfway. And I loved that.
That's terrific. That's terrific. It reminds me of something the poet Robert Bly told me years ago that he got from his years of association with Joe Campbell,
mm-hmm.
that made perfect sense with all the work I had done with him. And that is that Campbell reminded him as a poet, and then I think all of us, a whole generation, through Bill Moyer's Power of Myth and our films and so on, that all great art has a dark thread through it. If something is only inspirational, if something only vows to tell you we are going to soar, we're going to move towards the all-encompassing light, I suggest you call a taxi right away.
Right, right.
You leave the room, you leave the bookstore, because that's only half the journey. If you don't go dark down into the darkness and then emerge out of that into some kind of light, it's not true inspiration, or it's an inspiration that is a kind of infatuation with the light, with transcendence. It's not the complete thing.
And do you see that a lot in contemporary spiritual literature, particularly the New Age literature?
That's the very definition of it.
Yeah.
That it's only a soaring towards the light.
Right.
And even a kind of condescension about the darkness, suggesting that the world is an illusion,
mm-hmm.
that there's no such thing as strife. It's all in our heads. It's all in our heads.
Mm-hmm.
We only loved each other, but well, I'm the first to believe in transcendence and the power of transformational love, but not without some kind of struggle with your own conscience, your own personal demons, and as well as the shadow of the time. And that's why we really revere the work of a Pablo Neruda or Emily Dickinson or a Ray Charles. They wrestled with their demons, and out of that came a message, a work of art, a quality of creativity that becomes universal.
And you have an entire chapter about that in your book, Once in Future Myths, where you talk about the myth of creative struggle, and that there are these moments of tremendous joy and epiphany, and yet we will go back down again like Sisyphus and have to climb back up again, and it never gets any easier, really. And to me, that's the truth, Phil. It's not, okay, this is the way I was. I had an enlightenment or an awakening, and now everything's just hunky-dory. I haven't had that experience in my life.
Yes, yes. That essay, The Myth of Creativity, in my book, Once in Future Myth, is one of my favorite pieces of writing from my own work. And it came about in an unusual way. I had nearly finished this book, which is a series of six essays on contemporary mythology, in which I kind of take the baton from Joe Campbell and try to describe myth in our own time. So there's the myth of art, the myth of time, the myth of the city, the myth of sports, and so on. And I had finished 340 pages of this book, and yet it didn't feel like it was my voice yet, which is pretty dangerous when your deadline is looming, right? And yet, I was still uncomfortable, and I found myself coming home from a local cafe here in North Beach, the Italian part of San Francisco, late one night, climbing Telegraph Hill, where I live at the top of the hill here, and suddenly realizing that I felt like the weight of the world was on my shoulders. I carry this old leather satchel that I write about a lot in my different books, and suddenly the satchel felt like the boulder of Sisyphus on my shoulder. And a whole stream of associations came back, namely a number of talks I've given on Sisyphus on my literary tours. I've led a number of tours to places like Ireland, France, and especially Greece. And when I tell my own stories, my own renditions of the Greek myth, they really come alive for others. And it dawned on me, why don't I write a book from exactly that voice, my storytelling voice, and describe this, what I deeply believe is part of creativity, and that is it's a push of the boulder, and the boulder is the weight of your troubles in the world that you have got to get to the top of the hill. And once you push that to the top of the hill and you finished your symphony, your piece of sculpture, your book of grandma's recipes from England in the 19th century, whatever your creative work is, there's a moment of ecstasy at the top because of this accomplishment. And yet, it's not a Pollyanna moment either. To arrive at the top of the hill with a work of art, or to marry your college boyfriend, or to get the job of your dreams, does not mean you're going to stay at the top of the hill. That's the fairy tale as opposed to the myth. The myth is the deep reality for adults, and the reality is eventually the boulder is going to roll back to the bottom of the hill. And the question is, what is your attitude towards that? Is it going to be like B.B. King says in that famous song, "Nobody loves me but my mama, and she could be jiving too"? Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
And it's, I thought I had reached the top with that book. I thought I had accomplished my life's dream by marrying so-and-so, getting that job, buying that house, getting that car. And then we turn into a culture of whiners here because the boulder rolls back down to the bottom of the hill. A reality, incidentally, that virtually every other culture around the world sees as perfectly in sync with life. There is a rhythm of accomplishment and then starting a whole series of works or projects over again. It's a cycle. And so I was inspired, of course, by the famous essay by Albert Camus, the French essayist, in which he wrote this three-page essay on Sisyphus in the middle of the Nazi occupation of France, near the beginning of World War II. And this essay became so famous that French soldiers, especially the resistance force, kept copies of it in their pocket during the resistance.
Amazing.
It was that inspirational. And essentially, Camus was saying that Sisyphus has been condemned to the underworld by Zeus, but it was a decision of choice. He sacrificed himself in order that his people in the city of Corinth, ancient Corinth, would live. And so the struggle that he took on, let's say you and I beginning a book, or somebody starting a movie, or somebody starting a business, that is a sacrifice that we have willingly made to create something. There is no creation without sacrifice. And so when Camus gets to push that boulder to the top of the hill, Camus writes glowingly, "We have to think of Sisyphus happy as he sees the boulder go back to the bottom of the hill, and he follows it out of an act of will." Now, I find that to be one of the most inspirational stories ever written. The fact that we are constantly challenged in terms of our attitude. You've only got a year to write this book. You only have 6 months to live. I know I've had friends who got that news from their doctors. What is your attitude towards that kind of sentence by the gods, so to speak? And out of that, I think every person who longs to be creative comes up to that essential decision. Difficulty, complexity, resistance from their own soul or resistance from the world. Well, guess what? That usually means you're onto something. If there's no resistance, if there's no struggle, chances are you aren't challenging yourself enough in the creative act.
And one of the very simple phrases that I came back with after reading that essay was just, keep your shoulder to the boulder. I'm a simple woman, you know, that sort of can stick with me when I'm writing at 3 o'clock in the morning or something.
Yeah, that was a deliberate play on words there. But if you notice the image, the metaphor is in the body. It's not an abstract.
Mm-hmm.
I am deliberate about that because I've been an athlete all my life and I love coaching kids. And my problem with a lot of the New Age work or many books on creativity is the absence of the body.
I hadn't thought about that.
Taking care of our body, unless we use words in our work or images, if you're a painter or a mosaic artist or a sculptor, so unless you're using the body, I think you're just contributing to the cerebral movement of the arts or the over-spiritualization.
In an imbalance, really.
An absolute imbalance. So shoulder to the boulder is an image I think hits people immediately. It means take it on. Take on that struggle. Take on the critics. Take on your best friend who mocks you because you just started a novel. I think everybody who attempts to be creative will face invariably some kind of cynicism in the world. And if you take it too personally rather than archetypally, it will destroy you. So I like this image. Okay, they don't think I can do this. I'm putting my shoulder to the boulder, and I'm going to push that sucker up the hill anyway.
Well, and you know what that is, and this is another area where I connected with you. It was that I have been involved both in athletics and done a lot of manual and physical labor, and I think some of the little-known facts about your life are that you worked 40-plus hours a week during college in an automotive parts factory and harvested date trees in the blazing sun on an Israeli kibbutz, cleaned apartments of the rich and famous in London, and painted, 44 Victorian houses in San Francisco?
Yes.
So you know what it is to work.
Yes, and that gives me added incentive when I'm up against the wall in a book or a film nowadays. Once a year, I'll have a nightmare that nobody's buying books anymore, nobody's buying films for TV, and somehow I am back in the steel factory in Detroit where it all began.
Ooh.
So I'll wake up in a cold sweat and usually put my clothes on and head right back to the computer. I am not going back. But so there's two things about that. One, it gives you a tremendous sense of endurance, satisfaction that you can work with your body. It's very good for intellectuals to do some kind of physical work.
Absolutely.
I think it's imperative. And the second is that once you've done it, you can realize that there's nobility in it. So you don't have this unfortunate supercilious attitude that many in the arts have towards labor. This is a part of our Puritan ethic here,
mm-hmm.
that people in the arts have often rather looked down at those who do the physical work in this country. If you've done some yourself, that probably won't happen.
Or unless you've seen the musical working, right?
Yeah, exactly. But at the same time, if you've done it for, let's say, I worked in the steel factory for 4 years and then painted houses here in San Francisco for 7, but all night working on my writing and my researching and putting myself through a kind of self-imposed PhD program to lift myself up. And that's the big question. Anybody who's tempted by the creative life, ask yourself, do you feel some kind of call to adventure? Do you feel a kind of destiny that you are destined for more than what you're doing now? If you have an inkling that that is so, don't let anything stop you. I think it's probably harder now than any time in history because there are so many distractions that will keep us from taking that call to destiny seriously.
Absolutely. And you're a parent. You know that we're involved with lots of other parents all the time on the soccer field or wherever. And I've actually had parents come up to me, mothers particularly, and say, how do you do all this? How do you do the mom thing and the, you know, in the plays and the radio show or whatever? And I can't not do it. And I think that's the answer. And maybe that's a little bit of what you're talking about is if one feels called or drawn to create.
Yes.
Have you experienced that as well?
Oh, absolutely.
Because you're really prolific as an artist.
Well, thank you. Yeah, working on my 20th book now. Everyone feels like it could be the last one if I give up.
No way.
Keep working hard. But I often think of that wonderful line by William Saroyan, who wrote The Man on the Flying Trapeze, who said, a writer is someone who can't write. And I love that double negative.
That's it.
Because it suggests that there is something irrational, in the best sense of that word, irrational, subterranean in us that is pushing us along. It's not the most natural thing in the world to write 16 hours a day, but it's very natural to have the sense of genius. And remember what the Greeks meant by it. It's this kind of indwelling spirit that
like the daemon?
Our destiny.
Is it the daemon or diamond, whatever?
Right, the daemon.
Daemon,
right. D-A-E-M-O-N.
There it is.
It's a kind of second soul, and it's soul in you that can be the voice of conscience. It can also be the voice of vocation. You're working in a factory, but all along you hear this call that says, I can paint. I know I can paint. Hmm. I can sing. I can get on that stage, that cabaret in downtown Detroit.
Now, did you do that?
Sorry?
Did you do that?
No, but I loved Motown growing up in Detroit. And if I wasn't going to play right field for the Tigers, I was going to try to be a backup singer for Smokey Robinson.
I'm interviewing Guy Finley. You may know who he is.
Sorry, who?
Guy Finley, he composed for Motown years ago.
Yeah.
Oh,
yes,
good stuff. Mm. But anyway, go, please continue.
So then the second aspect of what you just said strikes me. Remember, in Once a Future Myth, I have an entire chapter on the myth of time.
That's right.
And that has been the chapter that the critics have reviewed and discussed the most. It's what most of the mail about that book is about, because that hits us where we are right now. All cultures have had myths of sacred time to go along with chronological time. We're the first that doesn't. American culture, it's genius. It's innovation, right? It's our ability to be tinkerers and inventors. But the arrow of our genius goes straight into the future. And so we don't tend to dawdle in the moment very much as
That's
Americans.
Right.
But having lived in many countries around the world and traveled in many, many more, I've discovered that there are...
This is Sarah Robinson with Conscious Creating. And today I'm talking with author, poet, and documentary filmmaker Phil Cousineau. Phil, some people, as they are working on a creative project, reach a point where they're sort of in no man's land. They start asking questions like, do people even care about what it is I'm trying to create? Have you seen this in your work?
Figure in Hollywood, for example, is that 9 out of 10 movies that are begun are never finished. If you talk to editors at the big publishing houses, they'll say there's an alarming proportion of manuscripts that are begun that are never finished. People panic.
You think it's panic?
Halfway through, because they realize they thought it was going to take 6 months and really it's going to take 2 years.
Hmm.
Or it's much harder than it looked. Because when you pick up a book, often people will say, good grief, I could have done that. Right? Or you come home from a movie and
right.
have your wife or husband in the car and you say, I could write something better than that. My goodness. But my take on that is something similar to what I remember my dad saying when he took me as a kid to see clowns skating in the ice capades. And I thought they were the worst skaters in the world, but my dad had to tell me, no, Phil, son, these are the best skaters in the world. You have to know how to skate incredibly well to make it look effortless.
That's right. That's right.
And I've used that image forever to think, my God, it's the great ones who make it look easy.
It's like the clown in Cirque du Soleil. And I wanted to get back just to what you said about how easy things seem, and particularly, you know, there's the old joke, you know, among actors, how many actors does it take to screw in a light bulb? One to screw in the light bulb, and six to say, I could have done that. And, you know, and, but really, when we are craftsmen and craftswomen, hopefully the work is seamless, and we don't see the technique.
That's right.
Either in writing or visual art or music or acting or any of it. Because when we can see people working too hard, I think it's just not believable or soulful, maybe.
Right.
What I love about your work is that I know, as a writer, the work that goes into creating what you create. And I have not created anything like that yet. And yet, it does seem easy in some ways because it just flows so well.
Well, thank you. I also write 20 or 30 drafts of every book.
Do you really?
Make it look effortless.
Sure.
Like that. As a matter of fact, I had a book signing in Berkeley a number of years ago for a book I did called Soul Archaeology. readings from Socrates to Ray Charles,
hmm.
the first and probably only extant anthology on soul ever written. And now I know why. It was wildly ambitious of me to take this on. And yet I did it. And
you did.
I read every book on soul that I could find. I didn't go on to Google to pull up soul quotes like you can do now.
Mm-hmm.
I read the books and pulled the best passages and then wrote commentary on it. Anyway, after I signed the books of this book signing, one of the persons at the desk of this bookstore said to me that a number of the employees there were remarking about the scholarship in this book, and she said, what we want to know is what kind of software did you use? All of these amazing quotes.
That's terrible.
And I just looked at her. There's no software in the world I know that could do this, and if there were, I wouldn't use it. It wouldn't be authentic.
It wouldn't.
A great anthology is only meaningful if these are deeply read passages, personally selected and so on. So, yes, I have to do the work and then try to make it seamless. And for one reason, which is the kind of metaphysics of creativity behind it, and that is I'm still of the old school that real art casts a spell.
Yes.
It puts you into a kind of trance.
That's right.
The word that I like now that somehow crosses the boundaries of all my interests from spirituality to architecture to travel and sport is transport.
Transport.
The word sport, I found out doing my research on my most recent book on the Olympics, comes from an old Italian word, deporto, which meant to be mm-hmm. carried away.
Across the portal, or what were the terms?
Deporto.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one of the great lures in mysticism,
mm-hmm.
in sexuality, in creativity, and sport, a sense of transport. You know, I've worked a lot with Houston Smith, the great historian of religion.
Right.
And when Bill Moyers asked Houston what religion's great contribution was, he said, the offering of another world.
Mm.
So when you pray, he's suggesting, you are transported to this other world, another dimension. And that is the great intoxication, I think, of art. For 2 hours, you are transported to another world. For an hour reading the new Margaret Atwood novel, you are transported to another world. And if you see too much technique, that spell is snapped. And suddenly you're thinking about your laundry list, or you hear the traffic outside, and the spell is broken.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what a lot of younger people want to learn, need to learn. There's not, I don't want to tell anybody what to do with this, but they should know that if you're trying to show off, for example, with too much scholarship or too many fancy words or too many wild techniques in painting, you break that spell. And it's a sacred thing because most people go to art for the kind of transport that we once got from organized religion. Boy, you walk into that church and you are in another world for 2 or 3 hours. Nowadays, we walk into the movie theater or the museum with many of the same trappings, darker lights, high ceilings, a little darkness, a shadow world, and whap, we're in this world that I think we privately long for.
And all the senses are being engaged.
Yes.
Especially, I'm thinking, I had an experience in St. Peter's in Rome, and I'm not Roman Catholic, but going into the service and feeling, smelling the incense and hearing the music and feeling the soul around me in the stone and the tile and the sculpture. I mean, it was just amazing, being overwhelmed almost, transported into another world, to use your word.
Yes. Well, I've done a book on pilgrimage, the art of pilgrimage.
Right.
Still very popular.
It's a beautiful book.
What I think of as a tremendous surge of interest in sacred travel now, as opposed to thick-headed tourism.
Right.
I read a piece recently from a German magazine where they did a 10-year study on people who went on vacation as opposed to pilgrimages.
Right, right.
And they said people lose 20 to 30 IQ points every time they go on vacation. So that begged the question, why? And the researchers said, because there's no challenge. But if you go on an adventure, a real adventure, and become a traveler or a pilgrim in this sense, you come back stoked, renewed, challenged. And that's what we get out of great museums, which are not, sectarian. There's a universality to the great museums in the world. You don't have to be Dutch to go into the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. You don't have to be French to go into the Louvre. And that's what I think now about the great religious sites of the world. You don't have to be Catholic to go into the Vatican to be transported. You don't have to be Muslim to go into the Blue Mosque and have your breath taken away by the magnificent mosque in Istanbul. So there are some universals, and I think it often spirals, as opposed to circles, it spirals back to this yearning and probably this necessity for us to be transported. If we don't get that on a fairly daily basis, I think we as human beings become very rigid. People with no access to the transcendent, no access to art, no access to spirituality.
This is Sarah Robinson with Conscious Creating, and I'm talking with author, poet, and documentary filmmaker Phil Cousineau. Phil, what do you see as the fundamental drive towards creativity and art? Why do people create art?
It helps us, I like using the expression, leave a mark on the cave wall. Because my people, the Cousineaus, came from
Lascaux.
The same area where the Lascaux caves came from. And the fact that those caves go back to 22, 25,000 years ago, and they are marks on the wall. You see the handprints next to those bulging bowls, and you see that this was a very powerful thing for those early painters to do. They left a mark. And that still sends a chill through us now. You look back to the work of the really tortured artists from the Russian poets under Stalin, the musicians who kept composing under the Nazis and so on, and you see there's this unassailable urge to leave a mark that says, I was here.
Yes.
So last weekend I gave a workshop on the art of pilgrimage at Unity Tustin down in Southern California, and someone remarked during the workshop part that she had been writing in her journal, in her travels, many years ago, before she knew that this was the recommended thing for people. She said that's just how she was raised. But now she looks back and she says, everything that I wrote about there, from my dreams to my aspirations, she says, has come true. That what I was noticing back there 30 years ago while I was traveling were seeds. And she says, finally, I see there was an actual pattern in my life. Now, that is magnificent to me, because I think the number one scourge of modern life is this doubt whether or not our lives have any meaning and purpose.
So it was as if she was making a roadmap for her life? Is that what she seems to be saying? Or?
She was, right, marking things that she loved, things that she wanted to do. These are the kind of thoughts that come up when you're traveling. You have more time to contemplate your heart's desires rather than worrying about the everyday grind. And so you often are recording soulful thoughts that are just buried over in everyday life at home. And when you do that, a pattern starts to emerge. And when you find a pattern, you'll find some meaning. And that's one way to think of creativity. It's a way to mark down in a very imaginative way the pattern of the way that we think or feel or observe in the world. To go back then and read our old journals or look at our old sketchbook is to see that there's, generally speaking, some continuity.
Yes.
And I don't know about you, but that gives me a lot of solace to read something from 30 years ago, and I'm writing about soul. 30 years ago,
mm-hmm.
where I'm writing about the image of fire as something that you have to stir and keep stirring, otherwise the fire goes dead and you can't be creative. See, I thought I'd just come up with this in the last year, and then I looked at some old journals recently, and I see I've been obsessed with that image since my college days. And that gives me a little satisfaction to know that I haven't been wandering in the desert all these years.
Well, and you and I also share the common theme of having just lots and lots of different interests and different pursuits. I mean, you are primarily identified as a writer, but I see you as being an artist of all kinds and or a person with a lot of different interests that you pursue in a concrete way. And for me, sometimes the dragon of doubt, to use your metaphor, would come and breathe on me and say things like, you're just a dilettante. You know, you don't go deeply enough into any one area. And then going back to read the journals, I can see how everything I've ever done and done intensely and pursued intensely has led to meaning today in what I'm doing and prepared me for what I'm doing. And I think there's been a lot of self-acceptance by virtue of the fact that I do have journals and can go back and look. Have you ever had any of those insecurities yourself?
Well, constant. And it's because I constantly challenge myself with new topics, new projects.
Right.
I'm told life would be a lot easier for me if I had just written 20 books on one topic, 20 films on roughly the same topic. But yet I would have lost interest.
I'm the same way, the same way.
And I also want to see how all these varied interests intersect.
Right.
How does art, literature, poetry, religion, architecture, how do they connect? What's the overlap between them? Because that's the modern world. We need to know how these things interconnect, or we don't have as much real meaning in life. But you just sparked one other thought here that is one of the great distinctions I've heard in this whole conversation about creativity. And it's from the famous professor of creativity at the University of Chicago. And I will botch his name, but I'll try it anyway. Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi.
I've heard it, but I don't know.
As close as I can get. And he's made noteworthy the idea of flow.
Right, yes.
The idea of flow in sports, as we know, or in acting, for example, mm-hmm. or in creativity, is one of the highest states. It's close to ecstasy.
It is.
And it also reflects something I said just a couple of minutes ago about the lack of self-consciousness. When you are in flow, there's no ego there.
And that's
it's one
right.
reason why time seems to stop. It's suspense. You write for 3 hours, you look at the clock, and you can't believe where the time went.
And it drives your family crazy if it's not in the middle of the night.
Yeah, that's right. And so anybody doing anything creative, and I mean creative from raising kids to being a creative teacher, coming up with creative business plans at home, long for this state of flow.
Mm.
Get the intellect out of the way. Well, the intellect helps you get the foundation, the theoretical foundation, but the flow is where the creativity happens.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he makes a brilliant distinction where he says there is creativity lowercase c and creativity uppercase c. And the lowercase c is what everybody has and what everybody is. Everybody at some level is creative, just in the sense of wanting to make something, to give expression to something.
Right.
We're all creative every day. You might find a creative way to drive to work, which is a commonplace way to use that word. Now, you can trivialize it a little bit, but it is the way that the public uses the word. Okay, I'm going to be creative in the way I make my coffee this morning. So it just means doing something with a little personal flair, something a little innovative. And everybody every day secretly wants to be creative.
Right.
You want to do something that stands out. But creativity with a big C isn't necessarily elitist. And I want to make sure that we're clear about that. I don't mean we all, that only the Michelangelos and Da Vinci's out there.
No, but I was just going to say it's freaks like us.
Right. But the creativity with the uppercase
right.
C is something creative that you do that reaches the community and makes a difference. And I find that great. And so it doesn't.
I like that. And that is not elitist. No.
No, it just says, and sometimes it's accidental. You don't know what's going to happen.
That's right.
It might not even happen in your lifetime.
That's right.
But this kind of creativity is archetypal. And it only happens if you drop down out of the personality, down into this subterranean world where you are in touch with the gods and the muses. Sometimes maybe they are pulling you. We don't quite know how this happens. How did Mozart write symphonies at age 4? Who knows? It wasn't just chemical synapses firing. Something else is at work there. But that helps me to know that people like us don't even have to worry whether or not it's uppercase or lowercase things.
Right.
We should create.
Just create. And this,
yeah.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No,
I get so excited when we talk about this. And it just brings me to the thought of another thing you and I have in common is we both write poetry, and you have written some beautiful poetry. And in 2005, your book, The Blue Museum, was published by Sisyphus Press, your publishing company, and had some great reviews. It's available on your website, philcousineau.net. And would you... I wondered if we could end today, because we really need to have more than one conversation, but if we could end today with you reading a poem from your collection, perhaps a poem inspired by one of your parents, and then I will read a poem I wrote this morning that just sort of came to me, inspired by my mother. Could we do that?
Yeah.
What do you have? Or do you want me to go first?
Mind from the Blue Museum.
Well, you wrote one about your father. I don't recall the name.
Well, the one about my father in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. And then the one about my son as well, with Jack H. Ford.
I love that one too.
I can do the one about my father in Paris. Perhaps a brief lead-in.
Yes.
The title came to me when I was staying in Greece many years ago, and I happened upon a local fisherman pulling in his net, his catch of the day, and I asked him what he caught in those nets. And he was saying, oh, sometimes octopus, sometimes squid, and occasionally a statue.
Mm. Your father was a cultured man.
Yeah, and that's why we call her the Blue Museum.
Mm.
That's the old Greek reference to the sea, because so many ships had sunk over the years and dropped all of their art to the bottom of the sea. And for many years now, I have believed this is one of the most beautiful metaphors. The Blue Museum as a metaphor for memory itself, which I feel is one of the greatest spurs to creativity.
Mm.
We create so that we remember. There's a kind of terror in creative people of forgetting. So we make our mark on the cave wall to remember
for the rest
of our lives.
Yeah.
Okay, shall I read something here then?
Please.
Yeah. This is called For My Father, Who Never Made It to Paris. For my father, who never made it to Paris, I meet friends late at night in smoky cafes to drink frothy cappuccinos and listen to Coltrane sax solos on old jukeboxes and talk of the wounds of fathers and sons. For fathers and sons who never returned home, I reach down for words to express my grief, like an emergency ward surgeon groping for stray shrapnel in the flesh of bleeding loved ones. For all the words never found between men, the buried, burning words, slowly infecting us, I drop quarters in no-name telephones to call suicidal friends, distraught young fathers, lone wolf sons who howl at the indifferent moon and offer the round table of brotherhood. For for all the tumors caused by sorrow, all the ulcers formed by anger, all the nightmares wrought by rage, all the emptiness covered by despair. I probe friends and family for healing stories. For my father and all fathers who never saw Paris, one friend listens to me, reveals, reaches into an open wound, finds a piece of gold shrapnel, and cashes it in for airfare to take his father to the left bank in Paris so that the healing can finally begin.
Mm.
Thank you.
You cast a spell. Beautiful. Next time we'll talk about your relationship with your father, because I know he had a lot to do with your passions.
I'd be happy to.
Shall I read my poem?
Yes, please.
It hasn't had 20 revisions. Only one. Thermometer. It is an ordinary morning. The children are in late summer sleep and shuffling into my bleary-eyed kitchen. I stop dead at the sink. Just yesterday, I added a trinket to the windowsill, a red pepper porcelain bowl, adding a dash of color to complement a practically perfect life. I suppose I saw it then, that little thermometer of shell-embedded lucite, bearing the proud banner, Daytona Beach, like so many tattooed co-eds who would sell their very souls to bring home the prize from the wet t-shirt contest on the boardwalk each spring. And I weep. It was her very last gift. She was homeless, I think, washed up onto the sultry streets like a discarded sand toy. What did she sacrifice to offer her only daughter? Now 33 with girls of her own, this bizarre little trinket. A waffle, a steak burger, a Pabst Blue Ribbon beer. What? 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 She loved me. She must have loved me. She must. I gently place the object within my trembling palm, and it brings... and bring it ever so gently to my lips. Mother, my mother, I have something of you, and like yourself, it has no place within this pristine life of carefully selected accessories arranged just so. And yet, I say this one true thing. I would lay down my life to keep it always near me. For its sanguine mercury, which ebbs and flows within synthetic skin, is all I have left of you.
Wow, that's a powerful mark on the cave wall.
Thank you. Phil Cousineau, thank you for joining me on Conscious Creating, The Art of Transformation. It's been a real pleasure talking with you today, and I hope you'll join me again. To learn more about Phil and his work, visit his website at philcousineau.net. Thank you for joining us on Conscious Creating, The Art of Transformation. We invite you to visit our website at consciouscreating.net to give us your feedback and visit our store, where you will find books, CDs, and DVDs of our guests. Music for today's show is from Chakra Suite by Stephen Halpern and is used here with permission. Sound engineering is provided by Billy Fallon with Out of Sync Productions. This is your host and executive producer, Sarah Robinson, wishing you a fruitful week of conscious creating.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning in to our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.